As the summer of 2021 approached, Maggie Murdoch and her husband Alec were reportedly on the outs, having marriage problems. And it appeared as though the couple had been living separately. It was said that Maggie was staying at their million-dollar waterfront house on Edisto Beach, about an hour's drive southwest of Charleston, South Carolina. Alec was a prominent lawyer from a very well-known South Carolina legal family. For almost a century, the Murdochs had held the position of 14th Circuit Solicitor, which is the same as a district attorney or prosecuting attorney in other states. According to reports, they were very influential. While Maggie was staying at their oceanfront beach house near the Georgia border, Alec lived on his family's massive compound in South Carolina's Low Country. That's about an hour's drive northwest of the beach house. Now, to anyone who knew Maggie and Alec at the time, marriage problems may not have been that surprising. Their alleged separation followed at least a half decade of very disturbing and tragic events connected to their family. Tragic events that, when listed together, seemed like it was something out of a fiction novel. It all began on July 8, 2015. That evening, police discovered the body of a 19-year-old nursing student near the Murdoch family's Low Country compound.
A driver on his way to work calls 911 to report a body lying in the middle of the street on Sandy Run Road. The victim turns out to be 19-year-old Stephen Smith, a shy teen, but a funny and outgoing one to his inner circle. Smith was openly gay in the small rural South Carolina town he grew up in. The blunt force trauma to his head appears as a possible gunshot wound to the first responders on the scene, but the coroner's office later rules his death a hit and run.
The hit and run theory seemed questionable to his family, who noted that the autopsy results didn't support that, as Smith only had injuries on his head. They also said that Smith wouldn't have been in the middle of the roadway like that. Smith was a high school classmate of the Murdochs' oldest son, Buster. This from Fox Carolina News.
And his twin sister, Stephanie, also tells authorities that her brother had become very secretive about 2 weeks prior to the incident. Documents show investigators fielding tips about the Murdoch family in the days and months following his death. The first tip comes in early August, suggesting swirling rumors of a relationship between Smith and Buster Murdoch.
Despite the rumors, investigators didn't charge Buster in the death. They didn't charge anyone else either. The Greenville News reported that, quote, rumors hinting at a cover-up and the possible involvement of one or more members of the Murdoch family began circulating around the Hampton County area after Smith died. The Murdochs had been in control of the local county's court system for generations, between 1920 and 2006. To many in the local community, the idea of the Murdochs brushing the crime under the rug seemed possible, likely even. Then, on February 2, 2018, less than 3 years later, the Murdochs' longtime housekeeper, Gloria Satterfield, allegedly fell down a set of outdoor steps on the family's Low Country compound.
One day in February of 2018, Maggie Murdoch called 911, reporting that Gloria had slipped and fell.
What's going on out there? My housekeeper has fallen and her head is bleeding. I cannot get her up.
Okay, you said she's fallen. She's bleeding from the head?
Yes.
Gloria Satterfield died from complications a few weeks later. Local emergency crews reported it as a trip and fall. But the lack of investigation again raised suspicions. A coroner wasn't notified. An autopsy wasn't performed. Even the death documentation made little sense. From WJCL News.
A letter from the Hampton County coroner states Satterfield's death was not reported to the coroner at the time, nor was an autopsy performed. It also says the manner of death on Satterfield's death certificate was ruled natural, which is inconsistent with a trip and fall accident.
The deaths of Stephen Smith and Gloria Satterfield, and the scrutiny around them, may have been enough to shake any couple's bond. There was another simmering element, too, a financial element that further complicated matters both within the Murdoch family and beyond. When talk of civil lawsuits emerged, a lawyer representing Gloria Satterfield's estate heard a rumor that Alec Murdoch was broke and that he was somehow hiding it from almost everyone he knew. Then another life-altering calamity struck. Late into the night on February 23rd, 2019, and well into the early morning on the 24th, 19-year-old Paul Murdoch drank heavily on a boat with his girlfriend and two other couples. Paul is the second and youngest son of Maggie and Alec. Paul and his friends were riding in a speedboat that Paul drove. They sped from place to place on the rivers and tributaries near South Carolina's Parris Island. They began their evening at one of the Murdoch family's river houses. Then they boated to an oyster roast and drank some more. They stopped at another dockside bar, where Paul took multiple shots of liquor. While his friends allegedly told him that he was too drunk to drive the speedboat after that, he did anyway. Then, around 2:20 a.m. on February 24th, Paul crashed into part of the Archer's Creek Bridge in Beaufort, South Carolina. 19-year-old Mallory Beach went missing after the crash. Investigators didn't find her body until 8 days later. Despite the fact that an intoxicated Paul had been seen driving the boat, the Murdoch family privilege seemed to emerge again.
Then Beaufort County Deputy Sheriff Stephen Domino was one of the first on the scene. Anthony Cook told him he saw Paul Murdoch driving the boat just before the crash.
You all know Alec Murdoch?
Oh, yeah, I know that name.
That's his son.
That's who driving the boat?
Good luck.
Police failed to give Paul a field sobriety test. They didn't take him to jail. He wasn't even handcuffed. Paul remained free for months following Mallory Beach's death. Even then, he was charged with 3 felony counts of boating under the influence and released. Again, suspicion of a cover-up swirled. Mallory's family soon filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Alec and his son. On June 4th, 2021, court-ordered mediation failed in the Beach family's lawsuit. The Murdochs would soon face a very messy civil trial. And then, on June 7th, 2021, Alec called Maggie and asked her to meet him at the Murdoch family's Low Country compound. And he wanted her to bring along their son, Paul, too. The reason for the meetup? Alec told Maggie that his father, Randolph Murdoch III, was on his deathbed. He had long been terminally ill, and it looked like he might die that night. Maggie was suspicious. She texted a friend saying that Alec's request was fishy. She speculated that he was up to something. But she went all the same. The 911 call came in a little after 10 p.m.
Hampton County 911, what's your emergency?
This is Alec Murdoch at 4147 Moselle Road. I need the police to answer immediately. My wife and child shot badly.
Okay, you said 4147 Moselle Road in Allison?
Sir?
You said 4147 Moselle Road in Allison?
Yes, sir. 4147 okay. Moselle Road.
Stay on the line with me, okay? Hurry.
When first responders arrived, they found Maggie and her son, Paul, dead near dog kennels on the family's compound. Maggie was 52 years old. Paul was 22. They were both killed by gunshots from multiple firearms. Questions about their deaths swirled through the community. Was Alec responsible? Was someone seeking revenge on the family for the boating accident? Or for Stephen's or Gloria's deaths? And then Alec's life began to unravel, very publicly. In the months following the deaths of his wife and son, Alec admitted to having a long-time opioid addiction. Former colleagues accused him of siphoning millions from his former law firm into his own pocket. And he even admitted to attempting to stage his own murder, a scheme allegedly designed to give his remaining son, Buster, a $10 million life insurance payout. But still, Ellick maintained his innocence in the murders of Maggie and Paul. Investigators with the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, also known as SLED, weren't so sure. This is a clip from an interrogation room where SLED detectives interviewed Ellick in late 2021.
Did you kill Maggie?
No. Did I kill my wife?
Yes, sir.
No, David.
Do you know who did?
No, I do not know who did.
Did you kill Paul?
No, I did not kill Paul. So does that mean that I am a suspect?
With everything that we've talked about, with the family guns, the ammunition, nobody else's DNA, I have to put my beliefs aside and go with the facts.
Ellick remained free for more than a year. Then, in July 2022, prosecutors in the 14th Circuit of the South Carolina Circuit Court charged him with two counts of possession of a weapon during the commission of a violent crime. And they charged him with double murder. That set up what local media called South Carolina's trial of the century, and quote, one of the most high-profile and sensational cases in South Carolina legal history. Prosecutors claimed Ellick's world was crashing down on him, and that in order to save himself, he killed his wife and son in cold blood. While Ellick's attorneys claimed that Ellick would never do something like that, and that investigators were so focused on blaming him that they didn't look at other suspects. In the next two episodes of Court Junkie, we're going to walk you through the entirety of the Ellick Murdoch trial, which only ended on March 2nd of this year. We'll explain how prosecutors approached a trial against someone who was a prominent lawyer himself, and how that lawyer's defense defended against a sea of very suspicious-looking evidence. About halfway through the trial, many trial watchers were wondering if a jury would be convinced either way. This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 233, Part 1. I want you to imagine you're at a crowded grocery store, and you're cruising the wine aisle. Now, if you're anything like me, whenever I would do that, I would feel really intimidated, and I would just default to always buying the same thing. So back to you cruising the wine aisle. You want to explore and try something new, but you have no clue where to begin. Well, you need First Leaf. As America's most personalized wine company, First Leaf takes the guesswork out of wine selection. And it couldn't be easier. You just take their short quiz and then rate the first few wines they send you. Then, First Leaf will use your responses to curate a customized selection of delicious, award-winning wines based on your personal preferences. With 96% accuracy, you'll get a variety of new and exciting wines delivered right to your door. So no more standing in the wine aisle with a confused look on your face. And each bottle will be priced lower than what you'd pay at a wine store. You choose when to receive your wine, and every selection is backed by First Leaf's satisfaction guarantee. Now, many of you know I'm currently very pregnant, so I'm unfortunately not enjoying any wine for quite a while yet. But there's someone else in my house who may be a little stressed and who may like to unwind after a long day with a nice glass of wine. Not naming any names, but it's my husband. He started our First Leaf monthly wine club membership and loves it. Hopefully, one day I can join him. Sign up today and you'll get your first six bottles for $39.95 plus free shipping. Go to tryfirstleaf.com/court. That's tryfirstleaf.com/court to get your first six bottles for just $39.95 plus free shipping. Tryfirstleaf.com/court. It's the fall of 2017 in Rancho Tehama, California. A man and his wife are driving to a doctor's appointment when another car crashes into them, sending them flying off the road. Disoriented, they stumble out of the car only to hear dozens of gunshots whizzing past them. This is just a chapter of a much larger nightmare unraveling in their small town. This Is Actually Happening presents a special limited series called Point Blank, shedding a light on the forgotten spree killings of Rancho Tehama, where a lone gunman devastated a small town, attacking 8 different locations in the span of only 25 minutes. Overshadowed by the Las Vegas shooting that dominated the headlines just weeks earlier, this small community quickly faded from view and was left alone to pick up the pieces. The series follows 5 stories of people connected to the incident, from a father that drew the gunman away from the local school to the sister of the shooter. These are riveting stories that will stick with you long after you listen. I'm telling you, if you're a court junkie, you will become fascinated with this podcast. It's so well done and shows you the different perspectives after a colossal tragedy such as this one. Follow This Is Actually Happening wherever you listen to podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app. On Wednesday, January 25th, 2023, Alec Murdoch's trial began at the Colleton County Courthouse, only about 20 miles from where police discovered Maggie and Paul Murdoch's bodies. In his opening statements, Creighton Waters, chief attorney in the South Carolina Attorney General's grand jury section, led the prosecution. He began with a timeline of events for the night of the murders. Quick note, the Murdoch's Low Country compound is a vast 1,770-acre hunting ground on Moselle Road in Colleton County, South Carolina. When attorneys refer to Moselle or the property in Colleton County, they're referring to this.
On the evening of June 7th, 2021, at the defendant's property off Moselle Road in Colleton County, his son, Paul Murdoch, was standing in a small feed room in some kennels they had on the property. About 8:50 p.m., and the defendant over there, Alec Murdoch, took a 12-shade shotgun and shot him in the shoulder, in the chest and the shoulder, with buckshot. And the evidence is going to show it was a 1,000,000-to-1 shot. He could have survived that, but after that, another shot went up under his head and did catastrophic damage to his brain and his head. The evidence is going to show that Paul collapsed right outside that feed room.
He said just moments later, Alec then turned his attention to Maggie.
He picked up a 300 Blackout, which is a type of ammunition, but an AR-style rifle. And the evidence is going to show that the family had multiple weapons throughout the property. Picked up that 300 Blackout rifle and opened fire on his wife, Maggie, just feet away near some sheds that used to be a hangar. Pow, pow. 2 shots, abdomen in the leg, and took her down. And after that, there were additional shots, including 2 shots to the head that, again, did catastrophic damage and killed her instantly.
Waters alleged that Maggie and Paul didn't have a chance to survive. Neither had any defensive wounds.
As if they didn't see a threat coming from their attacker.
He said both were shot at extremely close range. Furthermore, he told the jury that he didn't believe Alec's alibi, that he was off visiting his elderly mother at the time of the murders.
And the evidence is going to show that the defendant, Alec Murdoch, over there, told anyone who would listen that he was never at those kennels. But the evidence is also going to show from these things that every one of us, most of us, carry around in our pocket, that he was there. And he was there just minutes before, with Maggie and Paul, just minutes before their cell phones go silent forever and ever. despite what he told people. I was never at those kennels. The cell phones are going to show otherwise.
Waters went on to describe the Lowcountry compound, the Moselle property. He said Moselle has the main house and the kennels or sheds. The main house has a driveway, but the kennels also have a driveway. And he said that driveway is commonly used as the main one. He pointed out that the mailbox is by the kennel driveway, right past the kennels where Maggie and Paul were murdered. He proposed a theory about what happened when Maggie and Paul arrived at Moselle that night.
I told you that you're going to hear evidence that Maggie did not like being in Moselle as much as she liked Edisto, the beach house. But that, on June 7th, 2021, she came back to Moselle. And the evidence is going to show that she arrived about 8:15. And the evidence is going to show that from the cell phones that Paul was there at the house, at the main house. And Alec Murdoch himself says that they ate dinner. And the autopsy is going to reflect both Paul and Maggie having similar stomach contents, indicating that they recently shared a meal together.
A large portion of the prosecution's evidence centered on cell phone records, on geolocation tech that allowed investigators to pinpoint the exact locations of Maggie, Paul, and Alec.
About 8:30, but 15 minutes after they arrived, Paul's phone starts moving towards the kennels. You're going to hear evidence again that the defendant said he was never at those kennels, that he was napping after they ate, and he was at the main house and never went there.
Waters also told the jury that Paul's cell phone would act as a kind of voice from the grave to implicate his father.
At 8:44 and 55 seconds, Paul recorded a video. He was down at the kennels because he had been talking to a friend of his. And you're going to hear from this friend because his friend's dog was in the kennels and they thought there was something wrong with the tail. And Paul was recording a video of it to send to his friend. 8:44 and 55 seconds. And on that video, and you'll see that video, and you'll hear from witnesses that identify Paul's voice, Maggie's voice, and Alec's voice.
He said the evidence will show that Alec was there.
Was at the murder scene with the two victims. And more than that, just over 3 minutes later, 8:49 and 1 second, Paul's phone locks forever.
If jurors hadn't gotten Waters' gist yet, he then spelled it out.
3 minutes after that video has the defendant at the murder scene with the two victims, Paul's phone goes silent forever. And in fact, another communication comes into the very friend that he was talking to, the dog, at 8:49 and 35 seconds, just 35 seconds later, and he doesn't answer. He never answers another thing forever and ever. And on top of that, Maggie's phone locks at 8:49 and 31 seconds, around that same time. And she never answers another text, never sends another text. 3 minutes, ladies and gentlemen. 3 minutes after a video shows he's at the scene with the victims, and he told everybody he was never there.
Waters then told the jury about the activity on Alec's phone.
So what happens after that? Well, you'll hear evidence that Alec's phone was conspicuously, he didn't have a lot of activity from about 8:09 p.m. until 9:02 p.m. And if he was at the kennels, which the evidence will show, why is his phone not with him? Why is it not showing activity? But you will hear that at 9:02, all of a sudden his phone does start to pick up activity.
He said at 9:04 p.m., he called Maggie's phone, but there was no answer. He then called his father, Randolph, who was at the hospital. No answer there. He then called Maggie again at 9:06.
Remember, he's just a third of a mile away. You can see it. At 9:06, she doesn't answer. At 9:06, he turns on his car, his Suburban, and he texts Maggie that he's going, be right back. I'm going to go check on Mom.
He told the jury they'll hear evidence about how Alec was acting when he got to his mom's house. He said he was only there for about 20 minutes because at 9:44, he made more phone calls on his way back to Moselle.
Calling friends, calling people who will answer. Be up to you to decide whether he's trying to create an alibi. And he gets back to Moselle at 10:01. And he calls 911 at 10:06.
Waters said that after the jury deliberates, they will reach the inescapable conclusion that Alec murdered Maggie and Paul.
That he was the storm, that the storm was coming for them. And the storm arrived on June 7th, 2021, just like the storms that are heading here right now. That they died as a result, beyond any reason.
Me time? What is that? I feel like between my four-year-old, my husband, my dog, and this new little baby currently kicking me in the stomach as I record this, I rarely have a moment to myself nowadays. The only time I get some me time is when I'm working. So to try and fit in a workout just seems so impossible sometimes. But with Peloton, it makes it a ton easier. For one, my trusty Peloton bike is right in my home office, so I can hop on for a quick ride way easier than I could if I had to leave my house and go to the gym. Not only that, but their on-demand classes make it incredibly convenient to get a good workout in, no matter what time of day it is or how long I want to ride for. I can do a quick 10-minute ride, or if I'm lucky, maybe even, dare I say, 45 minutes? Peloton works around my day, not the other way around. And Peloton is more than just a bike. They actually have a treadmill too. I know sometimes treadmills can sound intimidating, but you don't have to be an elite runner to use the Peloton tread. They have classes for every level. So whether you're looking for a short scenic hike, a beginner boot camp, or, you know, maybe you're just pregnant and you're looking to get a slow but satisfying 30-minute walk in. Am I projecting here? And I always say how much I love the instructors, and it is so true. No matter where you're starting from, their expert instructors are there to guide you. But more than that, they kind of become like your friends or workout buddies. Try Peloton Tread risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
Alec Murdoch's attorneys were Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin. They began their defense by painting Alec as a family man. Here's Dick Harpootlian giving their opening statements.
This is Alec Murdoch. And Alec was the loving father of Paul and the loving husband. You're not going to hear a single witness say that their relationship, Maggie and Alex's relationship, were anything other than loving. You're going to hear about how they went to a baseball game the weekend before. You're going to hear about their relationship. You're going to see texts and emails indicating a loving relationship.
Harpootlian told the jury that Alec had a loving relationship with his son Paul, too, and that cell phone data would help to paint that picture.
Paul, the apple of his eye. You're going to see a video somewhere between 7:30 and 8 o'clock, the night of the murders, with Paul and Alec riding around looking at some trees they planted. It's a Snapchat that Paul sent to other people because the trees were not planted very well. They were cantilevering over. They're laughing. They're having a good time. That would be about an hour before the attorney general says he swatted him.
Harpootlian's description of events took a grisly turn as he focused on the severity of the gunshot to Paul's head.
The second shot ended up, and there's going to be some question about the direction of that shot, but ended up his skull cavity, and the gases from that shot literally exploded his head like a watermelon hit with a sledgehammer. All that was left was the front of his face. Everything else was gone. His brain exploded out of his head, hit the ceiling in the shed, and dropped to his feet. Horrendous, horrible, butchering. So to find Alec Murdaugh guilty of murdering his son, you're going to have to accept of having a extraordinarily bonding, you can see it in the Snapchat, that he executes him in a brutal fashion. Not believable. Not believable.
Then Harpootlian focused on Maggie, saying that she was shot while she was running and that she had no defensive wounds because she was shot while running.
And after she falls to the ground and has one bullet that has hit her and probably traveled up and hit her brain, she's on the ground, and whoever the perpetrator was walked up, took that AR, and put one in the back of her head. Executed. Executed.
He then pulled apart a main assertion from prosecutors that there was no reason for Alec to leave Moselle in the hour before he called 911.
He left the house at 9:06, returns at 10:01 after seeing his mother who has dementia. Now remember, that day, his father, who is dying, is taken to the hospital. Mom's home alone with the housekeeper. Perfectly reasonable for him to want to go see her. And later than usual, because his father's not there. He's in the hospital. He dies 2 days later. His father dies 2 days later.
That was true. Randolph Murdaugh III was 81 when he died on June 10th, 2021. So Alec hadn't been lying when he told Maggie that he was on his deathbed. Harpootlian proceeded, focusing on Maggie's phone and how it specifically pointed to Alec's innocence.
And by the way, how do they find Maggie's phone? Maggie's phone was thrown out on the side of the road about a quarter of a mile away from, a little bit more, maybe a half a mile, from the Moselle property, thrown out on the side of the road. They found it by using Find My iPhone. And the way they did that, they had to open it or have access. Who gave them the code to open the phone? Now, Murdaugh.
He contended that Alec was, in fact, trying to get a hold of his wife.
Is that Alec Murdaugh was calling that phone at 9:06. As he leaves the house, he did call her twice and texted her. And we also know that at 9:06, as he cranks his car, as the cell phone records show that, as the telemetry data from the shows the cell phone linking up with the car, that phone is being thrown on the side of the road almost a half a mile away. Now that is Houdini. That is magic. That is inexplicable.
He offered an alternative suggestion that Alec really did return home to find his wife and son brutally murdered.
But let me tell you what is more believable. The night he comes home and finds his wife and son butchered. And when I say butchered, you're going to see these photographs. When I see them now, after having seen them for the last 4 or 5 months, it still shocks me. It still is tough to look at. It still bothers me. And he comes home and finds his son laying in his own blood with his brain laying at his feet, shot to hell. He walks over, he checks to see if there's any life there, although, I mean, he's seeing his brain laying outside his body. He knows there's nothing there. He goes over and tries to get a pulse out of Maggie. No pulse there. Calls 911. I want you to hear that 911 tape. It is a man hysterical, in grief, trying to figure out what's going on.
Harpootlian then described the incredible amount of biological material at the scene and how he said it also helped indicate that Alec was innocent.
Let me give you another fact. You're going to hear their witnesses explain the catastrophic injuries to Paul, that his head literally exploded. And whoever shot him with that shotgun was probably no more than 3 feet away, maybe closer, maybe a little further away. His head exploded. You would be covered in blood from head to foot. Head to foot. In blood. They seized his clothes that night. Sled did. And they test, well, first of all, you're going to see in the videos from the agent, the officers that arrived that night, there's no blood on him. They didn't find any blood on him. Sled's testing indicated 12 different places on his shirt and pants. No human blood detected. Period.
He told the jury that Alec was hysterical on the 911 tape, and that the minute a person finds their loved one dead, it's numbing and they go into shock. He said anything said that night is in the context of just an hour or two after finding his wife and son butchered.
He drove back up to the house while he's on 911 saying, I got to get a gun. That whoever did this might be out there. And he gets a gun. What's fascinating about that is he gets a 12-gauge shotgun and he grabs some shells. These people hunt a lot. They have guns everywhere. He grabs some shells. He puts a 12-gauge buckshot in. And then he put a 16-gauge buckshot in. That's how shook up he was. Guy hunted all his life, and he put a shell in that he couldn't fire a 16-gauge from a 12-gauge. Makes no sense. He was traumatized.
He emphasized that it is very strange that Alec was not covered in gunshot residue.
GSR, their own expert at SLED said the amount of particles of GSR are consistent with that him going up and picking that shotgun up. You want to talk about GSR? Again, if you fired a shotgun twice and a rifle six times, you'd be covered in GSR. Those are the facts. That's not his theory.
And, he pointed out, it was also very strange that Alec wasn't covered in blood.
The point of the matter is, he would have had to have executed both of them, got back up to the house, got the bloody clothes off. And by the way, they seized his clothes from that night. They'd never searched his house for any other clothes that we know of. Although that night, he gave permission and they got a search warrant. Go to my house. Go look through everything. Where are the bloody clothes? Where are the bloody clothes?
He said there were no eyewitnesses, no forensics tying him to the murder, no fingerprints or blood tying him to shooting anybody that night. He said the cell phone records indicate he would have had less than 10 minutes to kill them, get up to the house, and get in the car, and that he would be covered in blood. He concluded with a plea to the jury.
Now, all of you have indicated that you will follow the law. And I say this one last time. He didn't do it. He didn't kill Butcher, his son and wife. And you need to put from your mind any suggestion that he did. You've been picked because you said you could be fair. You were picked because you said you could follow the law. You were picked because Alec Murdaugh believes that you can be fair. Remember, as you sit there right now, in your mind, he didn't do it. He is innocent.
Initial testimony in Alec Murdoch's double murder case began on January 26, 2023. It focused on testimony from first responders. Prosecutors called Sergeant Daniel Green of the Colleton County Sheriff's Office. Sergeant Green was the first law enforcement responder at the scene. A dispatcher had told him that the 911 caller stated he found his wife and son shot. Prosecutors played a long clip, 45 minutes in all, from Sergeant Green's body camera footage. Sergeant Green described the scene for the jury. It was a typical June evening in South Carolina. Hot, muggy. It had rained on and off throughout the evening, and pools of water had materialized inside and outside the dog kennels. Sergeant Green said he didn't worry about a perpetrator at the scene, because Alec Murdoch had been there for a while.
So as soon as I got out of my vehicle, I was walking down the rest of the driveway, which went between the dog kennel and the shed. As I could see Mr. Murdoch down at the end of the driveway. As I approached toward him, I could see the male victim laying on the ground to my left, as well as the female victim on the ground to my right. The male victim was close to a small shed in the dog kennel on the left. There was a large deal of blood that had pooled around his body.
Alec told Sergeant Green immediately about guns on the property.
I want to let you know, because of the scene, I did go get a gun and bring
okay.
it down here.
It's in your vehicle? Do you have any guns on you at all?
No, sir. It's leaning up against the side of my car.
Okay. You're fine, man. You're fine. Turn around for me.
I don't have any
guns. Okay. Yes, sir. I see that. Okay. This is your wife and son?
And son.
Okay.
It's bad. Check the pulses.
Yes, sir.
When footage of Maggie's and Paul's bodies emerged in the video, Alec could be seen wiping away tears at the defense table. Sergeant Green said he asked Alec why he had brought a firearm with him. He said Alec seemed preoccupied about a boating accident involving Paul.
Did Mr. Murdoch give you any possible explanation for this when you approached him?
His immediate reaction was to start telling me about an incident that had happened with his son with a boating accident.
With the boating accident?
Yes, sir.
Had you asked him anything about that?
I did not.
Eventually, Alec told Sergeant Green that he went to his residence and retrieved a gun in case the killer was loose on the property. The gun was a camouflaged shotgun. Sergeant Green handed it over to SLED investigators when they arrived. Waters continued playing the video.
What is Mr. Murdoch doing at this particular time?
He's on the phone, pacing around, talking to someone. I'm not sure who he was talking to at that point.
Did he ask you to confirm if they were dead?
He did. He asked multiple times while I was on scene.
Did you ever see him, any tears, any physical tears?
I did not.
Did you ever see him approach the bodies?
I did not see him approach them, no.
Did you observe any visible blood on him?
There was no blood on him that I could see.
On cross-examination, Dick Harpootlian prodded Sergeant Green about the shells found inside the camouflaged shotgun. Sergeant Green said he didn't check the gun. Agents from SLED found the ammunition, 12-gauge shells and 16-gauge shells in the 12-gauge shotgun. There were multiple 300 blackout shell casings around Maggie's body, he said. What was Sergeant Green looking for? Harpootlian asked.
So the whole purpose for even trying to look up under him was to determine if there was an additional firearm on scene already, possibly under Paul. There was 300 blackout casings found near Maggie. They were trying to determine if there was possibly a 300 blackout rifle under Paul.
Harpootlian focused on who arrived on scene and how investigators made sure that evidence would not be contaminated. Sergeant Green said it's not his job to collect evidence. Regardless, Harpootlian replayed a piece of his body cam footage in which fire and rescue teams say they're attempting to preserve footprints. Harpootlian asked if on-scene investigators should have been collecting evidence without protective gear. Sergeant Green admitted it was unusual. On redirect, Waters focused more on this.
You were asked a series of questions about contaminating evidence. Are you aware that any evidence was contaminated in this case?
I'm not.
Did you engage in everything you could to avoid contaminating evidence?
Yes.
Did you, in fact, instruct your deputies set up a crime scene and instruct them to avoid areas where evidence might be contaminated?
We did everything we possibly could to avoid contaminating evidence.
Also in the body cam footage, Ellick could be heard telling officers that Paul had been threatened and punched because of his involvement in the boating accident. Ellick then alleged that Paul's death may have been related to the accident.
You were asked a little bit about the boat case. Did you have any detailed knowledge or understanding of the boat case when you arrived at the scene?
No.
You just knew very generally that there was some boat case, is that right?
Yes, it had been in the news.
Did you even realize that this was that Paul Murdoch when you arrived on the scene?
Not until he had brought up the boat incident.
And who brought up the boat incident?
Mr. Murdoch did.
And within a few minutes of you arriving, he's the one that brought up the boat incident, is that
he did.
Correct? And he offered that right out of the gate as a possible explanation for what happened here, is that right?
Yes.
After Sergeant Green, the state called Detective Laura Rutland of the Colleton County Sheriff's Office. At the scene, she located Ellick. She said he broke down crying after he saw Paul. In her initial interview with him, she said he told her he went to his mother's house to check on her. Then he went to his father, who was in a Savannah hospital. When he arrived back home, he said he expected Maggie to be at the kennels because she was a dog lover. Paul would likely be planting sunflowers. On the recording, Ellick stated that he and Paul had a good relationship and that, despite their marital problems, he and Maggie got along well. Why might someone have killed them both? The prosecution played the part of the interview where Ellick said Paul had received threats following his boating accident.
The only thing that what comes to my mind is my son Paul was in a boat wreck a couple years ago. And there's been a, he was charged with being arrested for being the driver. There's been a lot of negative publicity about that. And there's been a lot of people online. This really vile stuff, but when Paul's out and about, when people routinely, I don't think I know the full story, so I don't think they give it to me, but I mean, he's been punched and hit and just attacked a lot, so, but I mean, nothing like this.
Yeah. Any one person in particular or a group of people?
I don't know.
That you could think of?
It's not that I know,
sir. Other than being assaulted, has he received any direct threats related to the boat accident?
Oh, yes. All the time.
Recently?
Yes, sir. I mean, he gets them all the time.
Okay.
He gets them all the time.
What kind of,
I'm going to kick your ass,
Then Ellick floated another theory. He had just hired a groundskeeper, he told police in the video.
He told Paul a story the other day about how when he was in high school, he got in a fight with some black guys. And FBI undercover team observed him fighting those guys and put him on an undercover team with three Navy SEALs. And that their job was to kill radical Black Panthers. And they did that from Myrtle Beach to Savannah. Now, I really don't think this guy, is probably the person, but that's just so friggin'.
Yeah, that's kind of a far-fetched story.
It's weird, but he was off today.
Ellick's implication possibly being that the groundskeeper may have killed Maggie and Paul. The officer interviewing Ellick called it far-fetched. And soon, Ellick would in fact be their only suspect. Next week, in part two, we'll begin with testimony from an investigator who testified that she heard Ellick say, "I did him so bad," in reference to his son's death, which was caught on tape.
It's tough.
It's just so bad. It's so bad.
Alec's attorneys, of course, argued that that wasn't what he had said. They argued he said they did him so bad.
Did you hear they then?
No, sir, I did not.
Okay. But you would agree the jury gets to decide what he said on that tape. That's the best evidence.
I agree that they get to hear the tape and make their own mind up as to what he said. Yes, sir.
Also next week, Alec himself will testify and will make some shocking admissions.
Before yesterday, did you ever bring up what you told this jury about that Kennels to anybody in the prosecution or anybody in law enforcement?
No, I didn't have the opportunity to, Mr. Waters, because you would not respond to my invitations to reach out and tell you about all the things that I'd done wrong.
That's in part two. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, on Twitter at Court Junkie Pod, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched by Nicole Gusmerati and Matt Stroud and written by Matt Stroud. If you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads, hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, or receive our weekly court newsletter, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. Please consider subscribing to Court Junkie if you haven't already. And if you haven't yet heard our new sister podcast, Civil, covering cases and trials outside the criminal justice system, please check that out and subscribe. Search for Civil and Court Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.